Making our way through a chilly Tuesday morning. It's up to 42 degrees if you average the temperatures throughout the areas. Eric Smith joins us now, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, our friend who suffers this fool gladly and answers my questions. How you doing, professor?
I'm doing fine. It is a little chilly out there.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
Tell me about, I think we're up to five now. We've seized five tankers of Venezuelan oil.
Right.
How far you can get into this or not, but I guess international law says that how can we just seize this, or part of it?
I think what international law would say is that if a vessel is operating under sanctions from an international body, which these vessels are, and they're flying a false flag, which is basically what pirates did. Mm-hmm. And they are not protected by international conventions in terms of maritime affairs, so they can be seized. You would typically expect some sort of a admiralty hearing where they would say, okay, let's liquidate the vessel, liquidate the cargo, and pay off the claimants who have been stiffed by the Venezuelan government. That's what I would expect will happen.
So claimants would be, that was the other question I had. We hear about, you know, tankers seized and full of Venezuelan oil. Who was buying it? First of all, how much oil are we talking about, Professor, all told, when you talk about five tankers, roughly speaking? How many barrels is that you would measure?
Depends on the size. The tankers that are normally used for this kind of thing hold about 1 million barrels. The biggest ones are about 2 million barrels, and typically those are the ones going to China because of the long trip.
Okay, so let's say five million barrels, round numbers.
Yeah.
How much oil is that, comparatively speaking, to put it in a context?
Well, to put it in context, we use about 20 million barrels a day.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of oil, 5 million barrels.
But here's the thing. We don't really need it 100%. We need a proportion of it for our most advanced refineries, which happen to be along the Gulf Coast, many of them in Louisiana. And those refineries were built to run on a mixture of light crude, like the shale oil that we produce domestically, and this heavy crude. And the reason we wanted the heavy crude in to optimize the mix is that it allowed us to make more diesel and more fuel oil.
And that was the next question. I'm sorry, Professor. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So at any rate, when we talk about the benefits to Louisiana, they essentially come back to the fact that our refineries, these so-called complex refineries, cost about 50% more to build, but they had the capability of processing this heavy sulfur-laden heavy crude from Venezuela or from Canada or from a couple of other places. There's a Urals crude in Russia we've used in the past.
So
when we put in sanctions on Venezuela, that didn't change the refineries. They still needed to find this heavy crude. They had to go farther afield and haul it in from places that were further away. We set up the train link to the Baton Rouge refinery complex with Western Canada to get some of it down here. But all of that costs more than using the Venezuelan crude.
So when it comes to the oil that is in the tanker, are these things compartmentalized? Are we talking about all the same, for want of a better choice of words, flavor of oil or type of oil?
Well, that's a good question, Tommy. They basically, Venezuela has produced two different types of oil and has the potential for producing a third. They produced originally out of Lake Maracaibo, shallow water, pretty standard conventional crude, a little on the heavy side, but not terrible. They kind of played that out and then started developing an oil coming out of the sort of the uplands of Venezuela, which is extremely heavy, and it's more like the tar sands oil coming out of Western Canada. So that oil, in order to get it out of the ground, they have to mix it with water to get it liquid enough to pump, and then when they get it to the terminal by the seashore, they have to dewater it and then put it in the ships. And of course, they then have the problem: what do you do with all of this produced water that's got chemicals in it? And they re-inject those in the ground. But that's where the heavy oil comes from, is onshore. The third type of oil they haven't produced yet is oil like the oil in Guyana, which is deep water offshore, adjacent to Guyana, and that's a fairly light, sweet, low sulfur oil that's useful all over the world. But they haven't drilled any of that because they don't have any money to drill.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, 8:21, talking Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. I'm like a hyperactive puppy sometimes. I get so excited talking to the professor. I don't mean interrupting, but I got a lot of questions about this stuff because the professor taught me oil is not oil. We all tend to think that it's the same, but there's a big difference as far as what can be refined and what can't. When we come back, I got to believe somebody, first of all, the professor, before I do go to the break, do we have any idea what the value of this $5 million of oil is?
Yeah, it's worth a lot of money. It's, of course, like the Canadian oil, because it takes all this extra processing, you pay less for the oil itself. So if a standard barrel of oil coming out of the ground today is $58, let's say, the Venezuelan crude landed in the United States after the extra freight would have to sell like in the high 40s.
Wow. Okay. And times 5 million. 822 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Eric Smith, professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, about the seized oil. Some 5 million barrels, give or take a barrel, off of these five tankers that the U.S. seized, Venezuelan oil that was flying under a vessel with a false flag. So, Professor, when it comes to maritime law, when it comes to all of this stuff, how quickly can anything like this happen? Do you know?
Well, I think that's the $64,000 question. I think it can't happen very quickly. What we
can
could
or
do,
cannot?
Cannot,
okay.
Mostly because of transportation issues and the state of the processing equipment onshore in Venezuela, which has been not maintained for at least the last 10 years. If we can't get the water out of the oil, that water is fairly corrosive and it's not good for ships. That's why they tend to use these older tankers at the end of their lives. There's a limited number of those tankers available. We don't want them in our fleet. Nobody else wants them in their fleet. So they're, you know, they're, this is their sort of their last stop before going to the scrapyard. But if we want to import meaningful amounts, and don't forget, we already import Venezuelan crude to Chevron's refinery and to the Citgo refinery, for example, here in Louisiana.
Even though it's, what's the word?
It's sanctions, except for Chevron. Remember, Chevron was kind of our listening post, and they're the last remaining major oil company in Venezuela. And they bring in collectively about 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day of this oil, which is like half a ship or quarter of a ship, because Pascagoula has shallow water. You can't bring big ships in there. And we can get 50 feet. You know, in most places, we have had, you know, so-called Aframax tankers, a little bigger, go up to Lake Charles. But that's about it. There's just not a lot of those small tankers around.
So there's a lot of money sitting in a ship. Somebody's on the other end of it, whoever bought it. Cash flow-wise, if nothing like this is going to happen quickly, somebody's out. I guess the bigger message here to me that the Trump administration sent is mess around and find out, because okay, you paid for this oil. I presume they paid for it. I don't know what the terms of the transaction were, but I mean, there's a lot of money just sitting in a tanker, and people are out of pocket for this, and this is going to be a big mess for somebody financially, is it not?
Well, it already is, and the chief culprit are people like India and China. China, in particular, has a legal right to move some oil from Venezuela to China, but they have to do it in vessels that aren't sanctioned, and they have not been doing that. So that when they really don't have a leg to stand on. But what I suspect President Trump will do will say, look, China, you can continue to. Oh, and the other thing is China already paid for the oil. They lent money in advance, and the Venezuelans are paying the loan off with oil. But there's still, you know, $1 zillion to go. And I think Trump will allow that oil to flow as long as it goes in legal tankers.
So who's eating this oil, this $5 million of 5 million barrels, not million dollars, 5 million barrels of oil, some 257 million, whatever the math turned out to be. Who's eating that?
Well, the guys that are going to take the hit, as I said, will be China. Of course, longer term, what's going to happen is we've just completed pipelines out of Canada to Vancouver, and that those barrels, it's only 17 days for that trip versus 57 for Venezuela. So even though the Canadian oil costs a little bit more, it more than make it up on the freight. So my guess is we're going to end up promoting Canadian sales to China at the expense of Venezuelan sales to China.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it as always. You have a great day. Eric Smith, Professor, Tulane's Institute of Energy. When we come back, we're going to talk about the last long-term farm bill. It expired in 2023, and Congress has been scrambling to pass smaller ones. What kind of impact has that had on farmers and agriculture in the United States? It'll be an interesting conversation. We come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:46, 14 till 9, chilly Tuesday morning. Tommy Tucker, WWL, thanks for getting your day started with us. We're talking to Christopher Newbert now. He's Deputy Director of the Sweetie Center for Sustainable Food Systems and Research Associate Professor at Arizona State. Thanks for the quarterback, Professor. I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I like the way you said that or not. Let's talk about the Farm Bill. What is the Farm Bill? We hear about the Farm Bill, the big Farm Bill. Every 5 years they have the big Farm Bill. Is it a bill? Is it different bills? Take me through this whole thing and how it came to be.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. First, let's start. Calling it a farm bill is sort of a misnomer. This is a massive piece of legislation. It has 12 titles. It covers everything from commodity policy to national nutrition policy. It's where we reauthorize SNAP every 5 years. It includes rural development projects. It includes energy policy. There's a forestry title in there. You've got conservation programs. It's really a large grab bag of programs that are important.
Catch-all? Would you go so far as to call it a catch-all?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a catch-all. It is, you know, it is focused on food and farm policy, but, you know, to say that it is only important to farmers would be incorrect. You know, this is something that touches the lives of every American. You know, basically, if you eat, if you live in a rural community, you know, your life is in some way going to be affected by this farm bill. And since the first one in 1933, they've typically been taken up every 5 years or so. There have been delays in the past. You know, there's always a sticking point or two, but this time has really been unprecedented. It's been 2018 since we passed a farm bill, and it doesn't look like conditions in Congress right now are really such that we will get a farm bill even this year. So they've basically been extending those programs every year since 2023. And, you know, short-term extensions are fine. They keep the programs moving. But when you're talking about, you know, real reform and real updates that are needed to all of these programs within the Farm Bill, it's really not coming along. You can't really accomplish that in a one-year extension that they attach to spending bills at the end of the year.
I'm sorry, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say it doesn't look like progress is going to be very good yet again this year.
So talk about, if you will, the way this has changed since 1933, because I would think, and maybe I'm wrong, my image of farming in 1933 is mom and dad, and maybe you got the sons, and you got maybe the daughters working, doing the ranching, the cooking, the plowing, the fixing the fences or whatever it is. And then they all get together for lunch, and they all show up at the end of the day. Then they bring it to town and blah, blah, blah. That's not the way farming is today, is it?
No, not at all. And, you know, in 1933, the very first farm bill were directed toward, you know, emergency relief. It was the Depression. Folks really needed help. And that's what the farm bills were. You know, so over the last, nearly a century, they've really evolved and grown and expanded to embrace a broad coalition and focus really on modern farming practices. Now, what farmers would like to see out of a farm bill, if we're talking specifically about farming, you know, they want programs that help them build markets. They want programs that, you know, really help them be successful out there on the farm today. And what we've got and what we've had for, you know, the last several farm bills are programs that really just provide price support. They're not doing the work of boosting and generating markets and encouraging real innovation on the farm. And, you know, a farmer will tell you the money's great. It gets you through the year, but it's not really a solution to the problem. And right now, without the sort of reform that we can get through a large comprehensive farm bill, it really is just plugging more money into a system that is badly in need of some change. You know, the big, beautiful bill last year just dumped another $60 billion into these programs. There was a $10 billion economic emergency relief package last year. There's the other $12 billion that they are using for tariff relief this year. And it's really a tremendous amount of money. And, you know, farmers will tell you what they'd really like to see is Congress get to work and fix these programs.
Let me take a break. We'll come back. Somebody texted in. We have a feature here where listeners can text in at 504-260-187. We call it the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line and get their thoughts in. Somebody texted and said, you can call it whatever you want. This is nothing but a huge giveaway to giant corporations. You can address that when we come back. We're talking to Christopher Newbert, Deputy Director for the Sweetie Center for Sustainable Food Systems and Research Associate Professor at Arizona State University. He already told us good luck on our new quarterback at LSU, 852, 8 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57 now, WWL, Tommy Tucker. I like to pop in and give you the time every now and then. We're talking to Christopher Newbert, Deputy Director of the Sweetie Center for Sustainable Food Systems and Research Associate Professor at Arizona State. Professor, to be fair, somebody said we should also thank you for Jaden Daniels, so thank you for that as well. When it comes the farm bill, who is the primary beneficiary of this? Somebody texted in before the break and say, call it what you want. It's a huge giveaway to giant corporations. But it gives a lot of things to a lot of different people. Is that accurate or not?
Sure. And, you know, that's not a characterization that I would necessarily disagree with. But I do think it's important to be clear about how that happens, because it's not like, you know, the federal government is writing a check to Syngenta or Bayer or, you know, the big corporations out there in this space. Yeah, exactly. But what happens is, you know, when these companies are out, if you ask a farmer right now what their biggest complaint is, it's going to be that the cost of herbicides, the cost of fertilizers, the cost of pesticides are all way up. You know, they're incredibly high. They're called their input costs. So, you know, these companies, when they see what Congress does, when they see that, you know, we just pumped $60 billion into this system, the first thing they're going to do is raise those prices. They're going to capture all of that money that we just pumped into the system. So the money, you know, goes directly to the producer. But the producer then is going to have to turn that around and spend it on increased input costs. There's no control on any of those costs. And, you know, these companies are not just going to lower their costs out of the goodness of their hearts. You know, they're driven by profit. They see this money, they're going to get as much of it as they possibly can. So very little of it is actually going to go to assist the farmer's bottom line. And, you know, for the most part, you know, farmers get it. They get the system. This is why they're asking Congress to do some work here and actually reform the farm bill. That said, you know, the largest part of the farm bill is all, you know, nutrition programs. It's SNAP. And those are programs that just took a huge 20% cut in the big, beautiful bill. This is why I think it's unlikely we're going to get a farm bill this year, because the only way you pass one is by having a coalition between farming groups and nutrition advocates. And if, you know, these nutrition folks just absorbed a 20% cut, they're not going to come to the table unless there's some real meaningful effort to pump money back into that system.
Thank you, Professor. A pleasure, and I hope you come back. Christopher Newbert, very enlightening, Deputy Director of the Sweetie Center for Sustainable Food Systems Research, and an Associate Professor at Arizona State. We'll talk about the inauguration when we come back.